Hi, everyone. Thank you for your patience, and welcome to another session of Speculations the Future Is. This is a series of talks and discussions put on by writers, economists, ecologists, technologists, people that we think have something interesting to say about the future. Speculations is being put on by Triple Canopy. We're an online magazine based in Brooklyn. My name is Dan Beisel. I'm an editor. Today, we're very pleased to have Ted Nelson with us. Ted Nelson, you may know, is the inventor of hypertext in the 60s. He also, we would not be here without him, as being an online magazine. He's in a greater sense kind of described his work as setting out to design a whole system of literature to replace all systems of writing and publication, which kind of makes him kind of a fantastic person to talk about how we could communicate in the future. In addition, he's invented the back button, which we kind of use in browsers every day. He's fantastic. We're so happy we could have him here. Ted Nelson.
Let's see. I will briefly introduce myself a little more, and then we'll get to what is probably a rather melancholy talk about the future. So, do we have projection? Yes. Oh, I need to move things over to the relevant. I just lost the page I have. Okay, I was going to show you what, where to look at my, just a minute. We're in a room without Wi-Fi, so I'm improvising. Okay, if you're interested in my current work, you might look at YouTube, but the way to get to what I'm suggesting you look at is you go to Google, not to YouTube, and type in the Ted Nelson with no spaces, and then that first item will take you to my YouTube videos. If you type that into YouTube, you'll get a whole lot of junk that I didn't put there. If you type it into Google, the first item will bring you only the stuff that I put there. So, I think of myself as the only real dissenter in the computer field. Everyone else wants to plump to hype, to enthuse about the current paradigm, which I don't. Partly because when I came into the computer world in 1960, I imagined a very different computer world. And like everyone else of my age, I'm still working on my original ideas. I don't know anybody from my generation of computer people that has adapted, because we all had original visions. And we were not hampered by having seen the web, or Google, or cascading menus, or Microsoft Word, and so we were free to imagine things an entirely different way. What do I mean? Well, for example, let's talk about computer documents. My design for computer documents is completely different from the standard computer document. By the standard computer document, I mean HTML, Microsoft Word, and PDF. They're all the same. They're all the same in that they are represented by a box of virgin characters who do not know where they came from, scrambled by markup so you can't reuse them. Now, to me, this does not make sense, because I think every quotation should be connected originally, initially, instantly to its source. And for this, you see, the conventional computer people call me crazy or clown or pariah, but I continue on my lonely crusade to do something entirely different. And I work on a low budget, because if you have backers, they take you over. The backer wants to use you as their paintbrush. And if you have backers, eventually you won't be on your project anymore. The reason that Gates and Allen and Jobs and Woz and Hewlett and Packard and Brin and Page were able to do what they did was that they got to viability without backers. And so that is why I am still on that same path, which is a lonely path because, of course, in the standard Silicon Valley view, the Palo Alto view of the world, creativity, the creativity of the computer field is really from venture capitalists, and you should play into their hands. And I think something entirely different. Okay, so what should documents look like in my world? Let me see if this will slide onto the screen. Yeah. So if you'll cut the spots, if you'll down the lights on me. Mike, can you turn down the light on me? Thanks. That's good enough. Okay, so here we are in a flight of document of Xanadox. And we see 11 pages in a space, in a connected space. Come on, stop. Whoa. Sorry, we're in a bug. I'm going to have to kill it and start over. This, by the way, is a prototype that I spent a lot of money for. I paid him $25,000 for a cross-platform application and instead got a single-platform demo that only runs on Windows. So I'm running it on the best Windows machine there is, which is the MacBook Air. If you insist on running Windows, which I do for some reasons, do it on a Mac. Sorry. Two-screen manipulation when you're spacing the other way is tricky. Come on. Over the left. Down. Yes. Sorry. My mouse got left at home. Thank you. Very sorry, guys.
You could mirror the screen instead, and then you could just face it.
That would take too long. And thank you, Paul. I could, but it's cabled up. So here we are again.
Do you have a little mouse?
I'd love
that. I have one right here.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Thanks. Okay. So here we are. These are Xanadox, meaning documents in the Xanadu system. And it's represented and done in an entirely different way from HTML and Microsoft Word and Adobe Acrobat. So every quotation is connected to its original source. Here we saw, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and that is from King James Bible. Now we step down to the next transclusion, and, well, sorry, just did a Mac thing where everything goes down to the middle. Come back. Step down to the next, and Adam and Lilith immediately began to fight. She said, I will not lie below, and that is from the alphabet of Ben-Sira. And we may step through the successive connections on this page. This page was actually written for this demo to show various connections as we step among them. So you should be able to see by juxtaposition or by line, visible lines, what the connections are. Here are the visible lines in three-dimensional space. So this is an entirely different model from the web or from PDF or from Microsoft Word. You see, in the standard model of computer documents, they have propagandized you into believing that a computer document should be designed around paper. You've heard the motto, WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. What you get when? Come on. What you get when? When you print it out. So they have propagandized you into thinking that it's about simulating paper. And to remove the capability of deep connection, a multidimensional connection with juxtaposition, with visible lines of connection, to lower yourself to the mere simulation of paper. This is like tearing the wings off a 747 and driving it on the highway as a bus. Now you see, some people talk about the paperless office. The paperless office is possible, but not by imitating paper. How did they get the horseless carriage? Did they get the horseless carriage by building artificial horses? No. They went to another method entirely. And the only way to have the paperless office is by representing the connections which simulations of paper lose. And the one-way connections allowed by HTML and now some of the trivial extensions of Acrobat, those won't do it. Those won't cut it. But everybody's saying, oh, how do we do this on the web? You can't. And that is why I hate the web. People say I invented hypertext. Actually, no. Hypertext was invented by Douglas C. Engelbart, my dearest friend who died 2 days ago. And he was the first person to put text link, to put links on text. He was the first person to create them. I was working independently. I didn't hear of him till I'd been working in the field for 5 years. But we got very close. He actually married me and my wife a year ago as the officiant. Anyway, I think he was one of the greatest men of the 20th century, but we won't get into that. So he liked this, by the way. So this is the Xanadu system. We're still stuck in prototype hell. I'm still trying to productize this. We're trying to take it apart. It's been converted to Python, and we may go to a GPL license. That is still under consideration. But in any case, this is the objective, to be able to do this, to edit the documents freely, and to have both links and transclusions visible and traversable. So the point is not only that you can see these connections, but you can use them as stepping stones. So I will now step from the pink patch on the left to the pink patch on the right. That means that we can connect documents into a weave of parallel structures. So the parallel document weave, parallel flying pages, or Xana weave, that is what I'm working toward. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with the World Wide Web. Okay, so that's where I'm coming from. And by the way, if you want to see my latest stuff, you might want to look at Computers for Cynics. Let's see, where is it here? Sorry. Well, lack of connectivity to the web has prevented it. But if you type into Google, the Ted Nelson with no spaces, into Google, not YouTube. If you type into Google, the Ted Nelson, the first item will take you to my series, Computers for Cynics, beginning with Computers for Cynics number 0, which is called The Myth of Technology. Because you see, everyone regards technology as this juggernaut, this bulldozer which must be obeyed. Whereas in fact it's a lot of conventions and a lot of crap that everybody is being carried along on. A tsunami of junk with many, many different underpinnings in an ever-increasing tangle of complexity. So you might like to look at my Computers for Cynics. Oh, also I might as well get a plug. Two books, Geeks Bearing Gifts, which has been called by Brewster Kahle, the founder of the Internet Archive. It's been called by Brewster Kahle, the best computer history book ever written. And people say it's nice to reread because there's so much stuff in it about the origins of what people think were sprung from the brow of God. Everything that's out there, everything you see on a computer screen is an imaginary concept that someone carried through. Just as everything you see on a movie screen is an imaginary concept that somebody carried through, except for documentaries. So software is about imagination. And we need to reimagine a better world. And here's my autobiography, Possiplex, which James Burke, Creative Connections, I read it in one nonstop surge because I couldn't put it down. Like its author, it's fascinating, brilliant, and crazy. Very well. Now we go substantive. I mean, this is substantive, but it's another subject. So I was asked to talk about something I'm optimistic about. Well, the problem is, I'm not optimistic. Because, well, let's start with, let's go back to 1453, or earlier. When was it? It was in, let's see, my notes here. Sorry, why is it not working? Oh, yeah. In the year 285, the Emperor Diocletian partitioned the Roman Empire into the eastern and western halves. So the eastern was under Rome, under the city of Rome, as always before, and the Emperor of Rome. And then the western was, well, still under the Emperor of Rome, but later it got to have its own emperor and its own very strange ways, which we call Byzantine. In the Western Empire, which everyone thinks of as Rome, a succession of emperors who fought each other would be in control. In the Eastern Empire, they had a different system where when the next emperor got in control, he had all his brothers strangled by eunuchs. This is called Byzantine because it was the Byzantine Empire. Now, old Rome gave way to Italy, but a nation that still called itself Rome existed, and that was in Constantinople. And it existed until 1453. And in 1453, it fell to the Turks. If you read about this on Wikipedia, they say, well, it wasn't too bad. They don't get into the atrocities. But most accounts have it that the inhabitants of, they still called themselves Romans. And most of the inhabitants of Constantinople were either put to the sword or enslaved. And thus, Constantinople became Istanbul, and Turkey began. Now, I think this is a good analogy to our present situation. Because as the Turkish armies approached year after year, decade after decade, nibbling away toward the frontiers of Constantinople, everybody worried about it. And nobody could do anything about it. Everybody knew what the situation was, and nobody could do anything about it. And that's where we are now with the future of the earth. I'll keep it simple. I'll leave out issues like pollution and deforestation. Let's just talk about population and petroleum. I didn't have time to look up how many people there were on the earth when I was born. In 1937, there were about, I just turned 76. In 1937, there were a couple of billion people on the earth. We've now hit 9 billion. And they're saying there will be 12 billion at the middle of the century. What will be the maximum? Now, my good friend Heinz von Förster wrote a very famous paper in the 50s or 60s saying that there would be standing room only on the planet. And that is, of course, absurd. Something will happen before that. But something will eventually happen to control human population. Now, the optimistic economist, there's one happy TED video. The TED Talks, you have to understand, I decline to give TED Talks because they all have to be optimistic. There's one happy TED Talk where you see this economist gesturing, I think he's Finnish, and these lovely bubbles fly into space in front of him, indicating the growth of the middle class in various countries. And so eventually the Earth will bottom out as we all move to the population of Earth will reach a peak as we all move into the middle class. I think this is unlikely. Because the problem is, you see, no matter how many people there are in the middle class, the poor reproduce faster. And as Thomas Malthus sadly observed, there are few limits on the growth of the poor except starvation and disease. And so the more people we put in the middle class, it doesn't matter, because there'll be more and more poor. But of course, people keep giving to UNICEF, save the children. But the problem is, the more you do to save the children, the more impoverished children there will be a few years from now. So what is the outcome? Well, it seems to me, and I'm simply speaking here from first principles. I'm not an economist. I'm not they call me a futurist because I predicted a lot of things very accurately. But it seems to me, since we don't plan ahead, since there's no way of controlling this, that we will reach a peak and then there will be a population collapse. Why? Disease, starvation, war, because of course, as there's pressure on resources and as there is depression, genocide comes into play. It seems to me that genocide is a natural human reaction to bad times. When did the Nazis arise? In the 1930s, when the Reichsmark went into colossal inflation and everybody went broke, almost everybody went broke in Germany. There's so much we don't know in history. When I was a college student, I had friends, faculty friends, and the wife of my favorite astronomy professor had grown up or had spent her early 20s in Weimar, Germany. And she said, you know what I miss most about Weimar, Germany? On the dinner table, the big bowls of cocaine. There's so much we don't know about history. But genocide, the genocide of called the Holocaust, of the killing of so many Jews by the Nazis, arose at that time. And we've seen many instances of the killings of hundreds of thousands in recent years in various African places. And you say, well, these are aberrations. I don't know about that. What would you like? Am I not close enough? Okay, I could be closer. Ahem. All right. Are these aberrations? Well, they're aberrations as far as our moral precepts are concerned, as far as our caring for human beings are concerned. But are they aberrations to the normal structure of the human psyche? I think not. Just as rage and murder are in any of us, or in most of us, suppressed by various social mechanisms, so genocide is in all of us when it becomes necessary. Now, let's look back in history. To me, a key historical event was 89,000 years ago, give or take 10%, when our ancestors left Africa. I say our ancestors because I have most of the people in this room are white. But we're all African. So the people who left Africa were probably dark-skinned, and they went around to India mostly, and then spread out to Asia. Because we know genetically that the inhabitants of Europe and Asia, the human inhabitants of Europe and Asia, are a very narrow proportion genetically of the total number of human genes in Africa. So there's a much wider variety of human genetics in Africa still there. But all human beings have singing and dancing and marriage and bad tempers and love and cooking and clothing. All of these things are in the human trait. Where in the genome is the love of gold? I don't know. There's probably no specific gene, but all the genes fit together into this strange thing we call humanness, which has essentially not changed in perhaps 250,000 years. Anyway, so our ancestors crossed over to the Eurasian Peninsula, except apparently the Basques may be descended from the Berbers. That's a new genetic finding. But most of our people came out of Ethiopia, so maybe we're descended from Ethiopians. And we went into India. And why? What happened in Europe? Well, Europe was mostly covered with snow and ice 13,000 years ago. So if there were people in Europe ahead of 13,000 years ago, they're long gone. Their descendants are long gone. But when the snow and ice melted 13,000 years ago, our ancestors poured out of India through the Khyber Pass, and the so-called Indo-European languages, and with it the Indo-European genetics, split into the words escape. I have more and more word loss as I grow older. The Latinate and the Cyrillic, I'm thinking. The Slavic languages and the Celtic and the Germanic, all of these being derivative from the original Sanskrit-like language that we spoke back in India. And in this diaspora, as the snows melted, we populated Europe. And that was like 13,000 years ago. So when they talk about the beginning of history as 4,000 BC, because that was when they find written stuff and implements, well, we were on that continent, on the great Eurasian continent, much longer than that. By the way, there were folks on the Eurasian continent on the snow and ice. There happened to be a culture that could live on snow and ice. And they had reindeer. And we now call them Lapps. Except now, of course, they don't, that Lapps is, of course, an insult. They like to be called the Sami. And they have now retreated to the northern parts of Scandinavia and Russia. But that was a culture that could live on snow and ice. But the rest of us came through and became farmers and hunters and killers. And recorded history is only the smallest part of that. And I bet there was a lot of genocide before. We don't know what happened to the Neanderthals. The Neanderthals pretty much died out 50,000 years ago, and there's good reason to believe that that was our first genocide, but we don't know. We don't know if the Neanderthals had language. They're awfully like us genetically. We don't know a lot of things, but I digress. So the real issue is what's going to happen in the future. Now, suppose we do get to 12 billion on the planet. Remember that our way of life, a hot shower every day, Starbucks, two cars, that's pretty resource intensive. So let's talk about two issues: population and peak oil. Either peak oil has arrived or it hasn't, but the point is that the demand for oil, as things are moving on, is peaking, or rather is growing faster and faster, so the price can only go up and up and up. And the way of life in this country, which spread at the turn of the 20th century, when the house we're living in New Jersey was built, there were not that many horseless carriages. There were horsed carriages, and people would drive around with horses. Now that works. It's limited, and you have special constraints. And in fact, my grandmother, on a ravine near where we are, her carriage was nearly fell in the ravine. The two rear wheels are off, but the horse managed to pull it back on. This was about 1920-something. But by this time, the horseless carriage had established itself. So if you have horseless carriages, you can have suburbs, and you can have the population of a very large area. But as the price of oil increases, the difficulty not only of living in these places, but serving these places with mail, with fire departments, with police. Now, have you noticed how the police funding has gone down? With being able to service all these things with the so-called American way of life, this just becomes a greater and greater problem. And we're sailing along as if this is going to continue because there is no alternative. We could go back to the soil. They tried that at Brook Farm. They tried that in hippie communes in the 60s. It's hard work. The farm where we are in New Jersey, it's kind of interesting. We had a number of German neighbors who were the descendants of King George's soldiers during the Revolution. And George Washington sent a little leaflet off to the other side saying, "Hey, if you switch sides, you guys aren't getting very much money, are you? Well, we can't pay you right now, but if you come over to our side, we'll give you, at the end of the war, we'll give you a farm." And so our neighborhood was inhabited by the Zellers and the, I can't remember the other names right now, but a number of people who had come from Hesse as mercenaries and switched over to get their farms at the end of the war. And so they did. They were very rocky, and you couldn't farm them now because the yield is so light. Subsistence farming is not easy. There's the problem. A few people in Pennsylvania do it. And maybe some Mormons in Utah can do it, but we rely on cheap, vast agriculture that uses a lot of petroleum and cheap irrigation, subsidized, and cheap labor that comes across the border to give us all these vegetables, many of which are flown in. In England, the vegetables are flown in from Spain. You can see from Google Earth this vast valley completely covered with polyethylene sheets under which are grown the vegetables eaten by Europe every day. How long can we keep flying in the vegetables? I've heard it said that basically we are 5 days, modern civilization is 5 days from starvation. Because if the roadways stopped, excuse me, I forgot to turn on the camera. I might as well turn it on for the rest of it. I'm always forgetting something. I'd like to have the recordings, and then I forget. One of the problems of being absent-minded. They call it ADHD now. And one guy said, "You wouldn't want somebody with ADHD designing software, would you?" And the answer is, damn right you would. Because only some... I can't figure out how this family works. Oh, Christ. It's all set up. Sorry. Menu help. How to go from...
We do have video of the talk, and we can send you that video.
Are you doing? Are you videoing?
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Okay, good, then I won't mind. Because my better talks, I always forget to turn on the video. Of course you want somebody with ADHD to design your software. Because only somebody with ADHD understands the problems of concentration in the ever-distracting world for people who are trying to use the software. I say to my students, imagine the typical software user as a cross between Homer Simpson and Norbert Wiener. Norbert Wiener was one of the most absent-minded people ever. There's a famous story, which was, Marvin Minsky swears to me this is true. His wife said, Norbert Wiener was, he didn't coin the word cybernetics, but he's thought of as the great cybernetician and feedback theorist. But he was extremely absent-minded. His wife made all the arrangements, and one morning she said, now, Norbert, dear, today is the day we're moving, and I pinned our new address to the back of your lapel. And that afternoon, he remembered this was the moving day, and he looked behind his lapel. Incidentally, I went into a Best Buy a few months ago, and asked if they had a lapel mic. And there was a young woman with a clipboard and a headset. And she said, what's a lapel mic? And I said, it's a microphone that goes on your lapel. And she said, what's a lapel? So anyway, Wiener looked behind his lapel, and the address was gone. But he vaguely remembered the neighborhood in Cambridge where he lived. He was going to live. And he went there, and he looked around, didn't remember any particular buildings, and then he saw a young lad, and he said, excuse me, lad, but I think I live around here. My name is Norbert Wiener. And the boy said, sure, Daddy, I'll take you home. So anyway, imagine the typical computer user at a cross between Norbert Wiener, who remembers almost nothing, and Homer Simpson, who is irascible and makes snap evaluations of things that are extremely misleading. That is your typical user. So focusing the mind, making a consistent, plausible universe that the user can find his way around, his or her way around in, without being able to concentrate and without having to understand the depth of what you're doing, this is very tricky. That's it. Back to the future. So the simplest hypothesis about the future is that it will not be like the past. And at some time, the cars are going to be fewer and fewer and stop running eventually. And at some point, the population is going to drop precipitously. I say precipitously because, you see, humanity never does things rationally. We overbuild and overbuild until the earthquake smashes it all. Look at the economic crash of 2008. A number of people saw it coming. But were they listened to? My friend Harry worked at a big organization. I think it was Goldman Sachs, but don't quote me. As a risk analyst, he tried to warn them that securitizing poor loans does not a triple A bond make, let alone a triple A high class stock. And they said, Harry, that's not what we want to hear. So that whatever the mechanisms are put in place by well-intentioned people, they are always trampled to death. So what we are going to see sometime this century is a vast, horrible, precipitous fall in the population, accompanied by who knows what genocide, war, and paroxysms of horror. Now, foremost among those who have predicted this were Jay Forrester and the Meadows couple, I forget their name, who worked on the book The Limits of Growth with the so-called Club of Rome. I'll just net that out for you. The Club of Rome was a bunch of smart people basing their work on the dynamic models of Jay Forrester at MIT and saying, what if this happens or that happens in the future with resources? And they created computer models to predict the future. And they changed all the premises around many different ways. And the result was always the same. And that is that the world will come that civilization will come to a precipitous crash sometime between 2020 and 2050. And I found a website, which I lost, and managed to find 1 minute before I got on the taxi to come here. And I'll take you there now, if I haven't lost it in the confusion. Because you see, there's no internet down here. And I can't get you there. I can't show it to you if the loaded version does not remain. Well, the loaded version does not remain, God damn it. So let me tell you what it is. It's bit-player.org. And this guy has created a simulator for the Club of Rome simulations that you can use yourself in a web browser. Runs in JavaScript, and it seems to be a very credible version, and I recommend it very highly, because a lot of people have tried to come up with versions of the software that people could use, but with all kinds of clumsiness, and this appears to be a highly usable version. That's bit-player.org, and I had it open in a browser so that I could have run for you, but we've lost it. Okay, wait a minute, let me just one more time. Maybe it's under window. No, not there. Okay. So if we had this in front of us, I would show you how we could change change various resource parameters, population parameters, and so forth, and watch it go from decade to decade, and watch the lines converge. Now, this is by no means a proof. Any simulation is a simulation, but is a predictive simulation of great power. And apparently I've lost another of my the windows I had open. Sigh. Okay. So that is to the work of someone named Orlov. There's a very, very brilliant writer named Orlov. And his website is energybulletin.net. And it's node 23259. And this is his prediction of what will happen in the USA. And he says, oh, it's not a problem. The USA will collapse just the way the Soviet Union collapsed. And what you will have is panic in the urban areas. And in the suburban areas, well, all over, it will be a new fusion of the security services and the gangs, who together divide the authority structure of the new world. And he says much more, and he's a brilliant writer. And so I recommend that piece in particular, not because I'm endorsing its predictions, because who the hell knows what's going to happen, but simply because it is a very perceptive and clever writer who lived through the equivalent in the Soviet Union as the Soviet Union collapsed. But there was a huge difference. Because in the Soviet Union, they had a lot of free services that ran on a fixed budget and had been properly maintained, such as the Moscow subways. Whereas in our land, it is my impression that accountants have been encouraged to overlook a lot of deferred maintenance and to overestimate the quality of the infrastructure. And because of the union deals in place with the people who run the infrastructure, a great deal of money is expected to keep these things running, which no one has anymore. I would recommend the articles by Michael Lewis in Vanity Fair, of all places. If you go to vf.com/archive, Michael Lewis, that's L-E-W-I-S, is a brilliant writer on economics. He is not a trained economist. He is an extremely astute observer of human doings. His first book,
Liar's Poker,
thank you. I happened to buy, I have no idea why, but his first book, Liar's Poker, tells of his adventures at a major stock house and the disillusionment he suffered as he watched how these people played not just poker, but life. And he's gone on to become an extremely prolific observer and writer on the economic scene. He's not a trained economist, but what good have the trained economists done, I'd like to know. Economics, as I see it, is a science of looking for mathematical equations and equilibria and giving them names that match real-world problems. But the mathematical equilibria have nothing to do with the real-world problems. And so someone like Michael Lewis, I mean, how many trained economists said there was going to be a crash in 2008? Maybe a couple, but most of them not. So Michael Lewis is, of all people to me, the person to listen to when he says things are going badly. I have to tell one of his anecdotes. I love this because it illustrates so many things. Lewis was interviewing ex-governor Schwarzenegger, and they went for a long bicycle ride, I think in Santa Monica. And no one, this is early in the morning, no one recognizes Schwarzenegger. And they stop for a red light, and a woman is crossing with a baby carriage, and she's on the cell phone, and she looks over and says, "My God, it's Bill Clinton." So what this shows is how the human mind works. To mistake Arnold Schwarzenegger for Bill Clinton shows that there is a Arnold Schwarzenegger / Bill Clinton stereotype that was triggered by this vision. Anyway. So back to the unfortunately real world. How things are going to go down, and I mean go down, is unknowable. Because genocide is so deeply in our genes, there will be leaders who orchestrate it. Where, when, against whom is not clear. But it will happen. And you see, the charities are well stretched. Governments are all broke. They've been broke a long time, hiding it, except for Germany, apparently, and Switzerland. Will there be any safe havens? Who the hell knows? If there will be any safe havens, you could bet on perhaps Australia, perhaps New Zealand, perhaps Norway, perhaps Switzerland. But who knows what will happen? You can see that China may be in pretty good shape because they can at least hold their borders, and they may be sufficient in food. But those of us who depend on trucks and airplanes to eat and to go wherever we go, and cars to go wherever we go, we're going to be really up the creek. And how it's going to come down, I don't know. I think I've said everything I need to say, and I'm happy to throw this open. I'm just speaking not as a computer scientist, which I didn't know that I was until recently, and speaking not as an authority, because I'm not an authority on anything except a very intense thing, these certain very intense things I believe in. But I'm speaking as a private citizen looking around me in wonder and saying, what the hell, or what the fuck, as I guess we can now say, is about to happen. Thank you, and I'm happy to discuss.
Just a quick note. If it's possible for you to come up to the mic, that would help us with the video recording, just to get everyone's questions in mind. And if people can actually come up to the mic, just because people are sitting in chairs, if you could repeat the question into the mic, that would be helpful. Thank you.
And the question is,
who wants to speak?
You want to yell something from where you are?
I was going to ask a question before. I'm going to come to the mic. I was going to ask a question before about Mondo 2000, which I thought was so great back then, and how cyber culture might have changed now, and how there's a kind of a disconnect when cyber culture was more like psychedelic and hopeful, and our cyber culture just seems to be really based on jobs and money, and which I remember 30 years ago, it didn't feel that way. I thought Mondo was a really great culture barrier for that kind of culture, which I find to be gone now. And I wonder what you think of it, and what you think of the culture in the Bay Area, even as
Mondo 2000 was an interesting publication. I'm trying to remember the name of the gal who published it. Redhead. At one point I had to go on an errand and took her with me, and she said, "Is this a ruse?" And what was her name? Anyway.
Allison.
Allison Burt. Anyway. Great gal. But they kept changing the name of the magazine, which is not necessarily a good idea. And it ended up as Mondo 2000. Now, obviously, you see, with a name like that, you're going to have to change it after 2000. So what you want is something more stable. Any magazine is creating a paradigm, a bubble, a spirit. Consider the New Yorker versus Vanity Fair, the two most sophisticated, or two of the most sophisticated magazines in this country. It's interesting to note, by the way, that when the New Yorker was founded in, I think, 1919 or 1920, what was the principal magazine it was competing with? Vanity Fair. But it was a different Vanity Fair. And today they're still head-to-head with extremely good reporting. But the New Yorker has a consistent record of being pretty much the finest reporting in America. They did Hiroshima, where John Hersey went and interviewed and saw, and that eventually became the book, Hiroshima. So, Mondo 2000 tried to perpetrate an image of an exciting new reality. And they had, what's his name, the drug guy?
Travis McKenna?
No, no, no. I'm thinking.
Timothy Leary.
No. The reporter who goes by the name. Are you serious? Yeah, I forget his real name. And all these humorous things. Actually, you could say that the Mondo bubble, the Mondo image, was carried on to an extent by Wired magazine. I have to admit, I have to mention that I hate Wired because of an extremely vicious and lying piece they published about me in 1995, which is still spreading its poison. I hope to have an extensive video on the lies, exaggerations, and omissions of that piece, because if you Google me, there it is as number two. And the author is an extremely vicious, lying twerp, and I intend to... Pardon?
Who is the author?
I prefer to use the name Gory Jackal, though his official name is Gary Wolf. And I hope to disgrace him to the journalistic fraternity for all time. In any case, Wired magazine, which was founded by two people I thought were my friends, went on to essentially continue to pull that ethos into the bubble that they present every week. So it's a bubble where the excitement of the latest crap is brought to you with some good reporting on various topics, and a lot of futuristic gibberish. And a lot of ads. Of course, what is the purpose of a magazine? The purpose of a magazine is to sell ads, and so all the articles are there to pull you in. But I think I would say that Mondo 2000 and Wired were, in spirit, very similar, although I like the people at Mondo better. But what do I think of the Bay Area? Well, there was a wonderful piece in the New Yorker a week or so ago, called, in fact I have it in my downloads file, called Change the World by George Packer. And it's an analysis of the current, you could say, futuristic spirit in San Francisco. Now, though real estate throughout the country has fallen precipitously, in San Francisco it is booming because San Francisco has become a bedroom for people at Google, Facebook, and places of that ilk. And Packer has interviewed them. And it's interesting to see the kind of, shall we say, tunnel vision optimism with which they view the future, all thinking that apps and search will give us everything we ever wanted to know and make the world a happier, cleaner place. And that, in a sense, reflects the current spirit on the peninsula being below San Francisco, where I keep forgetting, this is the East Coast, yeah. I'm sorry, I go back and forth. The current spirit on the peninsula is that sort of upbeat optimism of associated with those especially who work at Google and Facebook, who have probably never lost a job in their lives and who aren't really in touch with what's happening in the rest of the economy. But it's all fad-driven. The latest slogan has huge ripples throughout the community. And so-called social media. See, I grew up with the notion that the IQ of a committee is the square root of the sum of the IQ of its members. And yet there are people who think that large groups are smarter than individuals. The answer is yes, in that by combining the individual special insights and knowledge that a number of them may have in some useful way, we can get a lot of knowledge. However, being able to do that is not easy. There's this dream called information annealing. I've just tried to figure out what the hell it means. The founder, either the founder or people who love wikis, by the way, Wikipedia, the encyclopedia anyone can edit. Don't you believe it? Any attempt you make to edit a Wikipedia page goes to their real editors who vote. And they have their own internal politics. For example, one guy was discovered to have 12 separate identities as different Wikipedia editors around the globe, giving him 12 votes. So it's a very tricky political process inside. Yeah, the notion of group editing is about as good as group direction of a motion picture. It is impossible. But wikis for maybe small subjects, or those topics where you have a natural convergence without a whole lot of argument. I would say that perhaps the discovery of the periodic table was one such, where Mendeleev, and actually somebody before him, discovered that the elements, the minerals of nature, lined up in columns with similar properties. And this is very intricate and by no means regular. But the regularities he discovered were extremely important, and all of chemistry is based on that. That could have been a group process with information annealing because there weren't a lot of surprises and there wasn't a lot of disagreement. Whereas on, I think, most subjects in the universe, there's generally a minority point of view, which can be very, very different. And that doesn't anneal very well unless you rule it out. There was a guy named... He selected the 100 great books. In the 1930s, this guy selected the 100 greatest books. In fact, when the new University of Chicago was founded, Robert Hutchins, its 21-year-old president, selected this guy as head of the philosophy department, whereas all the hired philosophers quit en masse. So he was then redeployed and created the great books where he decided single-handedly what the 100 great books that constituted what you needed to know culturally were. I'll get his name in a minute. In the 1960s, he was appointed editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I was following these matters at the time in the newspapers, and I believe, but I cannot find the article. I'm sure I clipped it. It's one of the cartons of clippings I don't have time to go through. I believe that 400 editors of the Encyclopedia quit en masse in protest at the fact that this guy had unilaterally decided every intellectual issue in the universe. So there are those who want to do it who cannot avoid the instinct to decide. But in fact, in every field, there are serious issues. I speculated in my 70th birthday lecture at the University of Southampton, which is online. One of my speculations was, you see, the conventional wisdom is that we have a planet with a solid crust and then a liquid next layer of magma, and then it gets solid again, and we have the nickel iron core, which is solid. That was what I was told as a child, and that's what most people believe. But it doesn't exactly make sense to me, and it gets hotter and hotter as you go down. So I conjectured that actually, and this would explain a lot of things, the center of the Earth is a spinning ball of plasma. And that would explain the reversals of magnetic flux, which will be found in the rocks. The sudden fall of the protective Van Allen belts at certain times when the flux reverses. And of course, this was an absurd theory in 6 years ago. But I just found it. Apparently, it has gained, not from me, but there are serious geologists who are now taking this position. Or if not a plasma, a liquid of some form. So, and then take the notion of petroleum. So many people call it fossil fuel. Oh, sure, all those oil fields were made by dinosaurs and plants fermenting and giving us oil, like top quality crude. There is the alternative notion. Yeah, why is it always under domes of salt? Why would decaying dinosaurs create domes of salt? The alternative notion is that they are veins of natural exudation from the earth, like veins of gold and veins of tin and veins of iron. That's not popular, but there are serious protagonists, and I think it makes much more sense. Anyhow, so there are, on all issues, let's not get into conspiracy theories, but there are, on all issues, minority points of view which need representation. And that is why, I don't know how we got here. But that is among other reasons why a representative system for showing documents as parallel and connected, so we can show alternatives, so we can show comments and disagreements rationally posted, not at the bottom someplace, but side by side by side and traversable on bridges of link and transclusion, that we can deal with the actual complexities of the world and of the world of thought.
Hello. So we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask a very brief last question in response to your talk, which was, I'm not asking you to be Ray Kurzweil or something, but I'm curious why...
Kurzweil?
Ray Kurzweil, or to, believe in exponential change within information technology and everywhere else, but I'm curious that you seem not to think that any of the problems you're describing, whether in terms of oil... don't obtain of some kind of technological solution, whether it's just solar cars or something else. You seem to be quite convinced that there won't be any...
Cynical is the word.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, why the tech...
I was the first believer in a glorious future. When I was a boy in the 1940s, the world was going to be chromium and stainless steel with robots at our every command, and we were going to be flying around in rocket belts. Remember rocket belts? They just retired the last one. You could build one, but nobody apparently does. I mean, there's all kinds of things nobody does. Do you know about Armchair Man? Google Armchair Man. Or, pardon me, what was it? Anyway, Lawnchair Man. This guy in L.A. who filled a lot of balloons around a lawn chair and flew to a height of about 2,000 feet, scrambling all the interceptors and creating holy hell in the air defense system and the air traffic control system. And then he wisely, sagaciously took along a BB gun, BB pistol, and then would shoot the balloons out one by one until he landed safely. This really happened. Anyway, so all kinds of things are possible, but we restrict ourselves very much. I have listened to the guff of artificial intelligence bullshit artists for 50 years. And while I believe that artificial intelligence is a set of useful technologies, properly understood, my friend Rudy Rucker, the scientific science fiction writer, says artificial intelligence is 5 or 6 cheap tricks. But since the 40s, it has been ruled by a number of sincere guys, so I won't call what they say bullshit, and hanger-on bullshit artists who talk about all the wonderful things artificial intelligence is going to do for us. But when you hear the term intelligent interface, run the other way. Because it means they're trying to outguess what you really want. So that to get what you really want, you're going to have to outguess the software that is trying to outguess you. Microsoft Word being an example. And Ray Kurzweil, while he makes wonderful musical instruments, I classify as a world-class loon. He believes that, well, there's something called the singularity. Have you heard of what is it, when everybody's going to, all the true Christians are going to be uphailed to heaven?
Rapture.
The rapture. So the singularity is the rapture of the technologists. So in the rapture, all the true Christians are going to be uplifted to heaven, and there'll be nobody left but us unbelievers. And I say, the sooner the better. But in the singularity, the world will be taken over by a vast mentality that knows better than us and has only our good at heart. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. But Mr. Kurzweil is apparently the principal advocate of this idiotic point of view. And I do not believe that there's a technological fix for everything. I believe that many things come out of the woodwork as surprises, as surprise solutions to problems. Sometimes the problems we didn't recognize as problems because we imagined they were insoluble. But like the heart transplant, okay, that's wonderful. But look at the expense and difficulty of the heart transplant. Now, China has been very generous to this, to heart transplants in offering us this great array of hearts and livers delivered on demand from their stock of prisoners. But that is a technological fix accompanied by, shall we say, accommodative social mechanisms that are not always available. I'm sure that somebody in the audience can think of another wonderful technological fix that's come along just in time for something, but it escapes me at the moment. I do have a friend who thinks there's a technological fix for everything, but there's the cost and the difficulty. And I am not much of a believer in those things. And that every rainbow has a pot of shit at the end. Consider the birth control pill, which was kind of wonderful. It certainly made the 60s and 70s more interesting before AIDS. But some of the downsides are, for example, the mutation of the fish near large cities where the birth control hormones, which also affect the fish, are affecting fish reproduction. And there's, of course, vast quantities of it coming out of the sewers. Also, the effect of the birth control has been to greatly lower the birth control of the middle classes, so the middle classes are dying out everywhere. Europe is not self-reproducing. Japanese population is falling precipitously, and they don't know what to do because, you see, it's almost impossible to become a Japanese citizen. Someone will be identified. I lived in Japan for 6 years. I love Japan, but it has many quirks, and one of them is that you're welcome in some ways, but you can't become Japanese. Very difficult. They did have one textbook example, a guy from Finland who became totally Japanese. In order to become a Japanese citizen, you have to have somebody come and inspect your house and say, yes, you are behaving at home just like a perfect Japanese person. Actually, they have the same problem in Switzerland. If you want to become a Swiss citizen, they come and inspect whether you're behaving at home as a proper Swiss. But the Japanese are not reproducing. They don't know what to do. The newspapers talk about Koreans living in Japan whose families have lived in Japan for four generations. They don't ever become Japanese. In the United States, hey, you're born here, no problem. You've come here, you go through this citizenship thing. And that way we renew ourselves. But so Japan has this catastrophic problem of fall of the middle class. Europe is having this catastrophic fall, and they're bringing in lots of people from outside, but oops, they're not assimilating quite right. And they're packing bombs instead of joining the party. So that was a response to the question of, is there a technological fix? And my cynical position is usually not, but we adapt somehow, or the people who couldn't find the fix die, and now somebody else who's left is carrying on life their way.
We're out of time, but thanks so much. And everyone, you should know that on Sunday, we have Esther Dyson coming to talk to us about healthcare, and we have Esther Taylor and Elizabeth Stark talking about education. Ted Nelson, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.